Now it's my great pleasure to welcome onto the show the legend that is Barry Whitwam from Herman's Hermits. Hello, Barry. How are you?
I'm very well. Nice to be with you, Suzanne.
Oh, pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Now, pleasure.
Fans will be happy to hear that you're touring once again. But before we talk about where you'll be appearing, let's go back a little, but talk touring. As one of the original members of Herman's Hermits, you've guided the band from strength to strength, and you're really one of the hardest working entertainers ever. Now, you and Herman's Hermits still average more than over 200 one-night stands per year. What motivates you to keep touring, and what keeps you physically able to carry on?
Well, physically, I'm pretty fit playing the drums, every 200 times a year. And a lot of those 200 times, we're doing an hour and 40 minutes, two shows, Herman's Hermits in concerts, which include a lot of rock and roll, a drum solo. So that five-minute drum solo is a great workout every night. And but I love travelling around the world, which we do, and we're very lucky and fortunate to do that, because we go to Australia once or twice a year, Germany a lot, and around the world. And absolutely love playing live to audiences. That's what I've always loved doing, and it's great to see the audience sing along with us, because we're very lucky, because everyone knows the songs. And at the end of the night, people are, we have a meet and greet after the show, and people come up and say, I've lost my voice, and my hands are sore clapping along with you. and we see, I know we go to the places probably once or twice a year, but it's fantastic doing that many different towns in a year. It's great.
Yeah, it must be a really good feel-good factor for everybody involved there. I mean, you've pretty much toured non-stop since 1964, touring the USA more than 150 times. I mean, few people could keep up with your packed schedule. And I understand your nickname is Bean. Does that stand for Jumping Bean as regards to all your energy, or is there another story behind being named Barry the Bean?
Yeah, it's nothing to do with baked beans either. what it was back in the, when I was a little lad, there used to be a cartoon show in England. It was called Billy Bean and His Funny Machine. And I was always making things out of Meccano and bits of wood. And my uncle christened me Barry Bean and His Funny Machines. And he's stuck. I've been Bean since I was about five.
Oh, it's a very endearing name, actually, I have to say. I mean, I believe you, talking of being young there, I believe you started drumming at the age of 14.
About 11 it was when I first started.
Oh, really? Fantastic,
yeah,
even younger.
Some guys in the neighbourhood had a band. And they had a drummer, but they didn't have a drum kit. And they said to me, if you can get a drum kit, you're in the band. Well, if anybody can get a drum kit, they're in the band. And so I persuaded my mother to lend me £40, which was a fortune, back in the late 50s, and bought a set of drums. And I was in the band. I couldn't play them properly at all for 6 months. I'd set them up left-handed. I'm right-handed. I didn't realise for 6 months why I was struggling so much. So I was in the band. It was called The Demons, and we played songs, tunes by Duane Eddy, The Ventures, Safaris and The Shadows.
Mm. Fantastic. I was going to say, I mean, who influenced your drumming right back to those days? But I guess some of those artists you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, fantastic tunes, and it's still, hold the weight today. It's great.
Yeah. Now, I mean, it's a little diversion when I say that you have a lovely head of hair. So I suppose it shouldn't be any surprise to hear that you used to be a hairdresser, but you also...
That's right. What happened, it's going to leave school, I didn't do very well, and I didn't fancy, like everybody else, going to either machine drawing, engineering, or working on the building site. My mother said, why don't you become a ladies' hairdresser? There's no competition. There's no guys doing it. So what we did, I borrowed 100 guineas. I was borrowing. I always paid you back, though. 100 guineas, and it was a six-month course, crash course in hairdressing in Manchester. And I did that, and one of the guys who owned the academy, as it were, had a string of hairdressing shops in Manchester. It was called Arthur's of Manchester. And he let me stay home for another 3 months free, because I was going to work at his shop. But after 3 months, it didn't work out. And I got a job in Eccles, just north of Manchester, at Mr. Collins. And my working name then was Mr. Barrington. And I built up very quickly a great clientele. But the trouble was with hairdressing, you work late Thursday and Friday, and that's when the shows were basically,
yes,
The Demons and So I used to get on my scooter after 8 o'clock at night, past 8, dash across town on my scooter, get to wherever the lads had set the gear up, and do about 3 sets. I was absolutely drained by, you know, the morning. I had to get up very early and back to the shop.
Yeah, I bet you were. I mean, it sounds like a real juggling act, but I guess it paid off, didn't it, really?
Yeah, it did.
I mean, I believe it was your father who said you could leave hairdressing on condition that you practised 8 hours a day. I mean, that must have been quite tough, not only on you, but also on your neighbours.
Yeah, on the neighbours, especially on the neighbours. But what me, I didn't find out 20 years after I left hairdressing is when I asked my father, can I pick up hairdressing and concentrate on the drumming, and that's when he said, he said, I'll ask your boss. No, he said, I'll think about it first. And a week later, he said, yes, you can do it. So I said, great, on Monday, I'll go and hand my notice in. What I didn't find out for 20 years later, that when my father had gone to see my boss and said, if his drumming doesn't work out, can he have his job back? And he said, yeah, perfect. You know, he's great. He's got a great clientele here. He's earned me a lot of money. My dad said, but when he comes to hand his notice in, tell him he's got 10 minutes to get out. I was devastated. I didn't find out until 20 years later.
Oh, really? Oh, he kept that a secret, didn't he?
Yeah.
Well, the wonderful thing was you never went back there, did you? Never have to.
Well, I went back, actually, two years later to the shop, and I parked on double yellow lines, and I had a boat. I was towing a boat at the time, and I was driving a Jaguar. And I went into the shop and said, can I see Mr. Collin? So he came down. He says, oh, hello, Mr. Barrington. I said, I can't stop. I've been on the double yellow lines 10 minutes, but I'll come back and see you one other time. He says, your car? I said, yes, I've got it. Bye.
Oh, fantastic. The sweet smell of success.
I saw him later on in life, and I did apologise for being such a big-headed
Oh, well, your bounty had great success. I mean, the name Herman's Hermit is just so catchy, but I believe it was originally Herman and the Hermits. Why did it change,
yeah.
And how did the name come about?
Yeah, in 1963, it was Herman and the Hermits, and they'd been down to London a few times to try and make a record with Mickey Most, and it'd not worked out. They'd had trouble putting a track down, and early 64, the band broke up after another attempt to make a record. And my band, which was then called the Wailers, which was Derek Leckenby, Ian Waller and myself, we were going to be the new Hermits, because Peter's manager, Harvey Lisberg, had seen us in the Twisted Wheel in Manchester and liked the band. He said, do you want the job as the new Hermits? And we said, not really, we've seen the band. He said, well, it's broken up now. Said, okay, maybe we should, just before you make your minds up, have a look at the diary. And it was 7 days a week. So I said to Derek Leckenby, the guitarist, I said, that's for me. I'm already professional now. I can't turn this down. We said, so all right, we'll join on the proviso that we change the name from Herman and the Hermits to Herman's Hermits. And in the meantime, Carl Green, the original bass player, Keith Hotwood, the original rhythm guitarist, and Peter got together again, made friends, and me and Derek Leckenby joined on April the 1st, 1964. Then a few months later, Mickey Most came up to see us again, see the new band. He liked it, and he left us a tape of I'm Into Something Good by Carole King. Earl Jean, I think it was, yes. Yeah. And we learned it, went down to London the next week and made I'm Into Something Good.
Incredible. That is such a wonderful song, isn't it? Do you still love that song?
Yeah, we're very lucky. He went straight to number one.
Yeah.
And stayed there for 3 weeks in England.
It's incredible. I mean, the mid-60s music scene was dominated by, you know, British acts, you know, household names, Beatles, Rolling Stones and Herman's Hermits. You were such a dominating force and one of the most successful groups throughout the world. I mean, so many great hits selling 75 million records worldwide. I mean, if you could pinpoint why that is, what would you say was the magic formula?
For Herman's Hermits, I think we were so different. And what made us very popular in America and other places around the world was a song called Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter, and I'm Henry VIII. It was sung with such a heavy English northern accent, and that really took off in America. And we were different to everybody else. We were like the new, you know, a boy band then. We were 2 years younger than everybody else. So the fans were young, and they got I think a lot of them got tired. The younger fans got tired of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and they came onto our side. And that happened in America, and it was we just had fit into a slot that nobody was in at that time.
Completely unique. I mean, I'm into something good, something's happening, No Milk Today, Silhouette, the list of incredible hits is endless. Which one for you personally seemed to just come together easily, and which songs posed the greater challenge?
Well, I'm into something good. That was the first one. It was a simple song. We'd driven down to London overnight and got to the studio in London at about 9:45, rushed in, set the equipment up, and we were out again in 2 hours, recorded the A side and B side. And that was, I think, the special song for me, because I'd already turned professional, and it sort of justified, you know, what all the gamble I took, packing ladies' hairdressing. And it was great to hear it on the radio. It was a great buzz. First heard it on Radio Luxembourg. Fantastic feeling.
Yes, was that the biggest buzz that you had from any of your songs?
I think so, the first one, yeah, when I heard it on the radio, I was playing it in my car and wound the window down and saying, the motorist, hey, that's me on the radio.
It's me, yeah. Oh, that must have been incredible. No, I mean, another incredible experience. I understand you met Elvis whilst touring in the USA, and most people might think of Elvis, you know, a night in Vegas, but I believe you spent an afternoon with him. Tell us
how that
came about.
What happened? He was filming Paradise Hawaiian Style in Hawaii in 1965, and we just finished a tour of America, which ended in Hawaii. I'm going home the next day, but the night before, we got a telephone call from Colonel Tom Parker, who was Elvis Presley's manager, and he said to our manager, Elvis Presley wants to meet the boys in the band tomorrow on his film set. And the manager put his hand over the phone like, he said, Colonel Tom Parker, well, who's that? He said, Elvis wants to meet you tomorrow. So anyway, we changed our air tickets, and as you say, we had 2 hours with him the next day on his film set. It was great. He was a gentleman, and I think he couldn't understand why five lads from Manchester, goofy-looking lads, were selling more records than he was. Yes, we were very lucky. We were getting all the best songs from the writers in England, because Mickey Most was so successful. He'd got the Animals, the Nashville Teens, Lulu, Cat Stevens, Donovan. So all the writers were sending their material to Mickey Most first, where we got the pick of the crop, as it were. But Mickey Most's talent was picking the right song to go with the right group.
Absolutely essential, isn't it? I mean, it must have been such an experience to meet the King. It was such a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. But then you've had so many professional and personal highlights. And I believe it was in Vegas that you enjoyed a 21st birthday with Keith Moon from The Who.
What happened? In 1967, our policy then was, when we toured America, we'd take an English group with us, just, you know, help them break into the market. And we took the Animals, the Hollies, Wayne Fontana, the Mindbenders, and we took The Who to support us in 1967. And his 24th birthday was a couple of days before mine, and we had a party in Flint, Michigan, in the Holiday Inn. And what the kid fans used to do, they always used to send us cakes anyway, but because it was my 21st, and Keith Moon's, it was about 200 cakes at the concert. And the road crew brought them all back to the Holiday Inn, and we hired the dining room for the night. And we had our own police guard there to, you know, to look after us and make sure nobody gate crashed. But we're just about to get stuck into the cakes, and the manager says, oh, remember the policy, you don't eat the cakes, because you don't know what the kids have put in them to bake them. You don't know what jealous boyfriends have put into cakes. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't eat the cakes, and Carl Green, our bass player, stuck his finger in the cream and flicked it at Keith Moon. So Keith Moon, not to be outdone, got a bigger a fistful, actually, and threw it at Carl and hit him in the face. So Carl grabbed all the Keith Moon's trousers and pulled them. But they came straight off, and he had no underwear on. At this time, the policeman pulled out his revolver. I don't know what he's going to do with it. Anyway, they escorted Keith Moon out, straight away out the side door, who tripped on the way out, smashed his teeth on the curb. So he spent the night in a dental hospital having his teeth fixed while the biggest cake fight ever seen started. By the end of about 5 minutes, you couldn't see the ceiling, the walls were all covered in cake, the carpet was covered in cake. In the morning, we had to pay $25,000 for for damages to the dining room. Some of the pool furniture was missing. That was fans. Somebody, one of the fans, must have had a scrapyard because all the railing around the pool had disappeared.
Oh, my word.
But we had to pay for it, but it was a good party, though.
Oh, yes.
And we were banned from Holiday Inns for life.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It wasn't exactly a quiet night in, was it? But it sounds like a scene out of Bugsy Malone with all the custard pies, but with cake. Sounds a laugh. Now, I must say, I mean, you must have quite a wall of fame in your house. Would you say that starting in the 60s, as you did, was the most vibrant and innovative era? And could you ever imagine starting now?
The 60s was fantastic, and as you say, I've got photographs dating back from when we first started up to probably yesterday, and I still get a buzz looking at the wall, all the pictures, and I'm still enjoying it just as much as I did then as I do now. Sad thing is, when you see the pictures, a lot of my friends have passed away, you know. Hopefully I'll carry on though.
Oh, absolutely. The thing is, it's like the music, and it just lives on. It's just so timeless, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's a wonderful time. Now, I mean, it's so great to hear that you're still rocking, and once again, you're touring all over the country and indeed all over the world. Would you find that, you know, when you're touring all around, do you find that, you know, with all the challenges that can go on in a tour, that a good sense of humour with the rest of the band members helps?
Yes, we've got a great sense of humour. I was classed as a practical joker in the 60s, and I'm still playing jokes now. In fact, the last gig we did with the Tremolos and the Sensational 60s Experience, they got the pole position on parking right outside the stage door. So what I did while they were on, I made like a parking ticket up, you know, the squares around the outside, and put it in a plastic bag and put parking fine on it and stuck it to the windscreen. So tomorrow when we see them, they probably know it's me.
Yes. It's been broadcast now.
Just imagine getting into the car and sitting there behind the steering wheel. It's a big parking fine ticket on the windscreen.
They're going to start to twig after a while. They're going to think, oh, this is Barry the Bean being naughty again.
Yep.
But I mean, now you're going to be for a series of one nights. Herman's Hermits are going to be performing in the Ultimate Sensational 60 show, along with, as you mentioned there, the Tremolos, the Union Gap and the Ivy League, four of the most influential bands ever. Are you looking forward to the show, and what can audiences expect?
Well, the Ivy League start to open the show. They're fantastic, very, very funny band. And then we have a compere who's one of the singers in the Ivy League. He's doing a great job, John Bremen. And then the Union Gap come on, and they do the fantastic songs by Gary Puckett and the Union Gap. Tom, the lead singer's got a great voice. Then there's we're raffling off a guitar for a good cause. And then there's an intermission, and Herman's Hermits open the second half, and then we pick a winner for the guitar, and then the Tremolos come on. They're fantastic, and after they finish, we all come back again and do a finale of rock and roll, about 8 songs, and after that we dash up to the foyer and have a meet and greet with all the fans and sign the programmes and whatever they want to, what else they want signing. It's a great show.
Oh, yeah, sounds absolutely fantastic, Barry. I mean, in relation to the other bands, have you all known each other for years, or is this the first time you've all toured together?
I've known the Tremolos 48 years. Our first tour of the UK in 1964 was with the Tremolos, and I've known Union Gap about 15 years. I've known the Ivy League probably 38 years. In fact, the drummer lives only around the corner from me. And it's a very friendly show, and we're having a great time touring the country with it.
That sounds fantastic. And I mean, for our local listeners, you're going to be at G Live in Guildford on the 1st of November at 7:30, and also you're going to be at the New Wimbledon Theatre on the 21st of November, and of course everywhere in between. I mean, which songs in particular are you looking forward to singing most on the tour?
My favourite song of this on this tour is There's a Kind of Hush. We get the audience singing along with it, and it's fantastic to get them to sing on their own. And it's quite amazing to hear, you know, 700 or 800 people singing along. It's fantastic.
That must be a real thrill. I mean, I personally can't wait to sing along to the show, and I must say it's been an absolute joy speaking with you today, and I hope the tour is a resounding success.
Well, thank you very much, Suzanne.
Thank you. And that was Barry the Bean Whitwam from Herman's Hermits, appearing at G Live on the 1st of November and the New Wimbledon Theatre on the 21st of November. Brooklyn's Radio.